Good morning. This is the time and place set for oral argument in Bright Source Energy versus Coyote Springs, case number 72273. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please tell the clerk how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal.
I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Good morning, Todd Kennedy, on behalf of Kennedy and Cuvier for appellant Bright Source Energy. May it please the court. At issue in this matter is a lease signed between Bright Source Energy and Coyote Springs, or CSI as I might refer to them as, on about April 1st, 2010, which for a period of about 2 years acted more like an option than an actual lease. And for a very good reason. There were threshold milestone issues that both sides recognized were very important before this lease ever had any value to Bright Source Energy as a solar power lease, and would need to be in place before Bright Source could commit the hundreds of millions of dollars that would be in lease payments and construction costs. And those issues were twofold. The first was they needed to have all of the permissions in place to actually build a solar power plant, which is a tower height, which is based upon tower height of a minimum of 650 feet. And the second, when you're generating energy, you need to be able to sell it somewhere. And they needed a solution for transmitting from a very remote area to a market for which they could sell this energy, most specifically California. So to that end, the contract provided that the lease could be terminated without cost until March 1st, 2012. But that cutoff could be advanced if the right to build a tower of adequate height, and it's always tower, it's always the height that is important in terms of the productivity of the plant, were in place, and they had figured out a solution to the problem of getting it to market. Those provisions are at Section 1.6C of the lease and 2.1C Roman 2 of the lease. Now, this case arose when Bright Source, having neither the right to build anything of any height on that land, nor having solved the transmission problem, exercised its no-cost termination right prior to March 1st, 2012. Now, in the litigation below, one of the key questions raised was by Coyote Springs was whether the right to a no-fee termination had expired early because the FAA had issued a no-hazard-to-aviation determination for a tower of at least 650 feet. This issue came to a head during summary judgment filed by Coyote Springs, where that assertion of, and that forms the basis, the primary, those proceedings, the primary basis of our assertions of error below, but certainly not the only assertion of error.
An order was not entered on that?
It was not, but the judge carried that order as a final determination through the trial and prohibited introduction of more evidence on the point, argument on that point, but there was no order, just a minute order. But the judge at the hearing was very clear that she was going to impose restrictions on what the parties could do at trial over that. It came to a head on summary judgment, where the court ruled the sole milestone for approved tower height was that FAA no hazard finding. That ruling couldn't, and it was done as a matter of law at summary judgment. That ruling could not be done as a matter of law and was a reversible error for several reasons. The first of which the ruling imported language you could not find in the lease for the definition of approved tower height. It relied on selective use by CSI of parole evidence while ignoring contrary parole evidence to get to that conclusion.
And did the district judge explain what the basis for her finding that was the meaning was?
Not that I could find, other than a declaration that it was the FAA is the final authority on this, and our position is certainly not. And in other points I'll make.
But she didn't specify at some point, look, it's because of this discussion, this negotiation, this meaning, this
the judge
evidence.
Talked about the parole evidence that was made, and troublingly, the judge also indicated that in playing on this decision in her mind, were documents submitted in camera, which my client never got to see or comment upon.
Right.
Wait, I don't know the extent, she didn't say the extent, but she certainly commented that that was working in her mind as part of these rulings.
How did, was there any argument for trade usage or course of dealing or any basis like that for resort to extrinsic evidence notwithstanding the parole evidence rule. And your opposing colleague faults you for not raising parole evidence, but I understand you were arguing it's ambiguous, so it's able to be considered, but it's an issue of fact.
Yes.
But did they justify the position? Because looking at this, could you argue that the judge properly construed the language of the contract in the context of trade usage, or was there anything like that in the...
There was no argument that this was custom and usage or trade usage, and the fact of the matter is there were no experts presented on that point. Look, this is a new industry. You know, building solar power plants is not something that's been around for a while. It's a little difficult to say there is some custom and trade established, but you would certainly need someone who is involved in that industry to talk about it. Kaiser Springs was a land developer, but their business wasn't building towers. There was no expert testimony. There wasn't even a definition of what that custom and trade would be. But the answer to your question, Your Honor, no, they didn't raise it below. This is new on appeal.
So that wasn't litigated and briefed. It wasn't a justification that was orally asserted or written.
No, Your Honor. In fact, what the argument was below by Coyote Springs was that the lease was clear and ambiguous, and here's a mountain of extrinsic parole evidence to show that you should add terms into the lease. and our argument, as you pointed out, was strictly that, well, first of all, we disagree if it can't be clear and unambiguous if you want to talk about all this parole evidence. And number two, there's a lot of contrary evidence, not the least of which is the very language that Coyote Springs was asking the district court to read back into the lease was struck out of a draft just before it was signed.
In their answering brief, your friend on the other side argues course of dealing in addition to trade usage as a basis for the district court's consideration of parole evidence in support of her interpretation of this contract. Can you comment on that?
I can say that, again, course of dealing really wasn't a factor. There certainly were pre-contract items of evidence, post-contract, one of the largest of which was...
The red line language.
First of all, that was pre-contract, striking it out, which I think is very probative evidence that the FAA was not the end-all, be-all of that approved tower height definition. Post, there was a summary. And it's evidence that goes two ways, but it's another issue on this appeal, which was a summary sent to the lenders for Coyote Springs, which certainly went through. BrightSource, of course, didn't get it. They could get a copy of that or an opportunity to comment.
But would this even be course of dealing evidence? I mean, I think it seems to me the evidence looks like course of negotiation, which if you have an integrated contract, you can't consider unless it's under the banner of something else, trade usage.
I would agree with Your Honor. I don't think that trade usage works here, custom and dealing, because all of those issues were things that really weren't between the two parties. It was, for example, the Post was more so, and there's certainly evidence from BrightSource that they always believed they had a right to terminate up until they got permits. That was part of it. Some of that evidence was at summary judgment. Some of it came in up until they got permits and real approvals to build that tower height. And, of course, then there's the transmission solution, which was presented to the court as a mutual mistake because it didn't make it into the lease nearly as clearly as the negotiations were in terms of...
But don't you have a clear and convincing evidence burden on mistake?
That may very well be, Your Honor. Our problem is we were missing a key piece of evidence that the court even said was material evidence in the loss of the testimony of the main negotiator.
But you could have gone to where he was incarcerated and taken his deposition, could you not?
We probably could have, Your Honor. Of course, we would have had to wait until this court determined the issue of that. And we don't know whether he would have remembered it or forgotten it by that time. At the end of the day, we asked the district court to preserve that evidence when it was there, when Mr. Whittemore said, I remember what was done during that conference. And Coyote Springs argued vigorously against doing that. The court agreed with them. And at that point, Your Honor, ultimately, BrightSource asked for the right remedy. It asked to preserve that evidence. It asked to have that testimony. Coyote Springs, of course, ended up making an incorrect assertion of privilege. And ultimately, BrightSource is paying the price for that. And that certainly isn't the way justice ought to work, that the party who incorrectly asserts privilege prevents the admission of evidence when it's there, fresh, and we know it. Well, they should not get the benefit of that.
What's the solution, though? If we were to agree with you in reverse, you're still not going to magically bring back Mr. Whittemore's memory.
So how
is it going to change?
I have struggled with that, Your Honor, because it's clearly an unfairness in my view, and I don't know what the remedy is because he isn't going to ever remember that. We've lost that testimony forever. If you liken this to a spoliation, there are remedies for that. It's difficult to go there, but those are the only remedies I see where you can get to a point where the harm is at least mitigated. I mean,
so
you can do a presumption.
Arguably a permissive inference. I don't think you're getting to intentional spoliation. Is that what you're going for?
I don't know that they would have been able to foresee specifically that he would forget. They did argue against the preservation of that testimony. At a time, they knew it was going to be years before he was going to testify, and they knew that this court works as hard as it can, but it does take time to work those issues through. And ultimately, he was their witness, and it was their job to make sure his testimony was available. We did everything we could. I see my time's expired. I can certainly cover a lot of those issues. At the end of the day, I would just sum up saying that if you look at what happened at summary judgment, that infected the entire trial in terms of rulings based upon parole evidence where there are disputed questions of fact as to the party's intent. And remember, the transmission solution and the tower height approval, they were two sides of the same coin. The project was not viable without both. It's very difficult when you predetermine the contract meaning and the result of one to get a fair trial on the other, because the court never got a full record on both. And that would have been very important here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. While Mr. Robison comes forward, I want to announce that we are honored to have Seth Floyd from Boyd School of Law in his appellate practice class here today. I'm very grateful to you being here. I had the opportunity to teach one of the seminars out there with Professor Floyd, and he's doing a good job. I meant to acknowledge him at the outset. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, honorable members of the court. My name is Kent Robison, and together with my partner, Tree Shanks, we represent CSI Coyote Investments. There were four issues before the trial court in the big picture. The first is what? What is approved tower height? That was litigated at the summary judgment level. The second big issue was whether approved tower height was achieved. The court permitted that to go to trial with extrinsic evidence. The third issue was when. When was approved tower height achieved? The court allowed that to go to trial with extrinsic evidence. The fourth issue was mutual mistake, a position taken by BrightSource that there was a mistake in the negotiations. So on the timeline, we get to the motion for summary judgment. And we did indeed ask the trial court in our summary judgment to consider extrinsic evidence to determine whether or not there was an ambiguity. Permitted by the cases we've cited, which I think are over 30 cases in our footnote, that the trial court should consider extrinsic evidence to determine whether a term is ambiguous. Now, the trial court at that level was presented not with a multitude of options. The trial court was confronted with two options. One, that the structures be permitted to be built is FAA approval of tower height. That was our position, supported by over 52 exhibits, parole evidence, extrinsic evidence, not objected to by BrightSource. BrightSource was willing and encouraged the trial court to make that determination based upon the extrinsic evidence. And indeed, BrightSource filed an opposition to which it relied, on which it relied on extrinsic evidence to determine, allow the court to determine whether or not the term was ambiguous.
So you're arguing that the court can consider all kinds of extrinsic evidence, the whole negotiations back and forth, before it decides whether the contract's ambiguous?
Yes. The court can consider extrinsic evidence submitted to it by the parties to determine whether or not a term is ambiguous.
Right, and but that's in the nature of the two ships peerless. I mean, where you need extrinsic evidence to establish that there are indeed two ships peerless, whatever the...
peerless and cotton and gun cotton.
Yes, exactly so.
Right.
To me, the extrinsic evidence in this case, and it's suggested by Justice Kadish's remark a moment ago, goes to negotiating history and understanding and back and forth. I mean, the draft with the red line that referred, you know, that gets taken out, that's different than establishing that the reference to peerless could mean this or that. And in this case, I'm troubled by the fact that you quite clearly have a definition of approved tower height that refers to permitted to be built, which can mean permitted to be built in the sense of, and the passive voice is a killer. I mean, it's just bad. Permitted by Lincoln County, BLM, whoever's issuing permits out there, or allowed in the sense of not interdicted by an FAA hazard finding. And so that's a classic ambiguity, and then you do have questions of fact, because if nothing else, just take the red line drafting history, where the one time this was expressed was permitted by FAA no hazard finding and other applicable authorities. I'm parsing here, but that drafting history phrase, if you're going to get into drafting history, is enough to get you to trial on summary judgment, isn't it?
We respectfully disagree.
Long speech, I'm sorry.
That I understand, and there are, I think, three primary areas I should respond to. One is the obvious, permitted. BrightSource drafted the first draft, had FAA approval in that first draft. Yes, it was taken out in March of 2010, but everybody had negotiated. They had seven people looking at this lease. We had three people looking at this lease. There were five different drafts. And according to the testimony of Mark Braun, their representative, who incidentally can be categorized as an expert in solar panel facility construction, because these are worldwide projects in which BrightSource is involved. And in Mr. Zahn's deposition, he said, yes, the FAA approval on tower height was the ultimate determinative predicate as to whether or not we would be able to get that approval. Later on, FAA...
Focus on, for just a moment, the red line language that was taken out. It's reprinted at page 9 of their amended opening brief, but tower height means the maximum feet, etc., pursuant to the final decision of the FAA and other agencies having jurisdiction to regulate structure height. If you look at that, and if I credit your argument that you can consider anything in establishing ambiguity, why wouldn't that establish ambiguity to a
perfect example of why the trial court has to penetrate the semantic surface of the document, to quote AM International, to see exactly why and what was going on that would have explained the deletion of that phrase. No question that everybody knew at that time, Your Honor, that FAA approval of tower height was the ultimate, the determinative factor. It was known by everybody, and that is why you have to look into...
How do you get to that evidence unless it's ambiguous? I mean, isn't that the definition of the parole evidence rule?
The answer is
we don't look at all that excess evidence in the whole negotiation unless there's an ambiguity in the contract.
Well, that's like saying that there has to be an ambiguity before the court can look at extrinsic evidence to determine whether there's ambiguity.
Uh-huh.
But that's not the law. The law is, and the cases are basically... not disputed, that the court must or should look at extrinsic evidence to determine whether the term is ambiguous. Please remember, Your Honor, there were two contradictory theories presented. One was ours, that notwithstanding the deletion of the language, FAA approval was the definition of approved tower height. Theirs was permitted.
Right.
Lowercase permitted. If you look at the lease at section 2.1C, Roman numeral 8, that is a defined term. Capital C, capital P, underlined in quotes, construction permit is a defined term. So if you interpret the word permit in paragraph 2.1C2 to be construction permit, then every word that says permit in the lease, and there are 12 different uses of the word permit lowercase, means construction permit. And the trial court had the opportunity to look at that extraneous evidence, extrinsic evidence, and say, no, that's unreasonable. And where the trial court is compelled or asked to look at extraneous evidence to determine whether there was ambiguity, then you can look at the counter-arguments by the two parties. And to adopt one has to be reasonable. The construction of permitted, lowercase, as being a construction permit was just determined by the trial court to be unreasonable. It only had the two opposing arguments presented to it by the parole evidence, by the extrinsic evidence, presented to it by BrightSource. And in the same tone, they made the proffer in mid-trial on December 13th, where they listed the extrinsic evidence they wanted to present to interpret the lease,
right,
not determine ambiguity. And then they did the same thing when they challenged the findings with their motion to amend the findings, address parole evidence. What we are pretty concerned about is that they asked the trial court to consider extrinsic evidence on whether or not the term is ambiguous. And now they come to this court and in their Rule 59 motion for the first time complain that the trial court erred in committing in considering extrinsic evidence. They brought up that whole argument basically an appeal and did not bring it up before the trial court. They did not object.
In summary judgment, weren't they arguing that in fact the term was ambiguous and that would allow consideration of extraneous evidence?
Yes.
Okay.
And they did present the extraneous evidence in their opposition to our motion for summary judgment for the court's convenience to determine whether or not the lowercase p was to be construed as a construction permit, and the trial court found that to be an absurd, unreasonable interpretation.
But crediting your position, summary judgment is any issue of fact, genuine issue of material fact, defeats summary judgment. And I can't imagine, as I'm sitting here trying to articulate a legal position, with your expansive view of the kinds of evidence that can be admitted to generate an ambiguity. Once that's done, the court has carte blanche to decide then the contested issue of, I mean, it seems to me you're shifting the goalpost. You're saying we're going to decide an ambiguous or not ambiguous by what's a reasonable reading in light of all the extrinsic evidence. And that, to me, is what precisely the parole evidence rule says you can't do if you have an integrated contract. And their point was, look, here's all this extrinsic evidence. There's an issue of fact as to what's a reasonable reading. We got to go through to trial where you can hear all this evidence and make that determination there.
But that determination is a question of law. That determination is a question of law.
But isn't it based on facts?
Well, it was in this case because both parties agreed that they could present extrinsic evidence. And now the base of this...
So if there's conflicting extrinsic evidence, doesn't that mean there's a genuine issue of material fact that precludes the finding as a matter of law?
Yes, if both positions presented to the trial court are reasonable, and that's what the authorities say. And in this particular instance, using the word permit lowercase interchangeably to mean construction permit from Lincoln County or from whomever was found by the trial court to be an unreasonable position for the court to adopt in determining whether or not structures permitted to be built is ambiguous.
So the judge is deciding reasonableness on a summary judgment motion?
No. The court is saying in order for me to consider BrightSource's position, it must be a reasonable one compared to the one proffered and offered by CSI. the extrinsic evidence with respect to what the court was looking at was also looking at the unanimous resolution from the Board of Commissioners from Lincoln County, in which Lincoln County said in June of 2010, mm-hmm. we adopt and approve the proposed construction.
Was that part of what was needed?
Their permission?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was given before the FAA determinations. So
is that one of the requirements for the timing requirement?
Well, you probably have to get a building permit to construct a tower. I agree with that. But was it a predicate to approve tower height to get Lincoln County? Absolutely not.
Why is that even relevant then?
Because we presented to the Lincoln County Commissioners a request to amend our development agreement to allow the construction of Bright Sources Towers. We had to amend our development agreement. And so we presented to the Lincoln County Commissioners the notice of proposed construction, which was supported by them, and the commissioner said in their resolution, provided you get FAA approval. So yes, they looked at it, they approved the project, and then they said, yeah, but, and we rightfully submit, notwithstanding Gallardi, that is an element of trade usage that they actually proved that subject to the FAA approval of tower height. That's what Lincoln County did. And they allowed us to amend that development agreement to allow for construction of the towers and the solar plant itself. So yes, we were dotting our I's and crossing our T's, waiting for that final factor to occur. And it did. Remember, we got the FAA approvals in August 10th of 2010. 30 days to appeal. Military, Fish and Wildlife, all the people that they say we need other approvals for, which evidently is endless, these other approvals, did not appeal the FAA determinations of August 10th at the tower height of 657 feet.
It's really a no-hazard determination, not an approval. I mean, to be fair in terms of what it's called, right?
But that is
in the vernacular, you're saying it's the same.
Right.
I have one more question of
yes.
you, and I'm going to
yes,
take you off your course here a bit. Your opposing colleague argues in his reply brief that the trade usage and course of dealing arguments cited to justify your resort to extrinsic evidence in the district court to support its finding, that they support that, those two doctrines, restatement type concepts. She cites Gallardi, and that's a trade usage case, but course of dealing, were either of those raised in the district court as a legal justification for consulting extrinsic evidence?
They were, without the trade usage label being put on them. And that
is also, course of dealing was not used as the label either, correct?
Correct. And we could see that. But if you look at what they considered, we have to just, Gallardi, I think, is a very probative example, Your Honor. Erickson comes in from the title company escrow business and says, look, we know what transfer fees and closing costs means, and that also means in a grand bargain and sale deed that you convey that property free of encumbrance. That means, Gallardi, you have to pay the $1.3 million mortgage, and it's taken out of your $8 million purchase price. That was a third-party expert. We had an expert, essentially, from the other side, BrightSource, Mark Zahn, which is almost more than objective, almost more than third-party. It is essentially a concession by Mark Zahn, the lead negotiator, that FAA approval is the determinative factor of whether or not there's going to be a termination fee or not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Do you have any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll add a minute since we went over with Mr. Robinson.
Thank you.
Mr. Kennedy, can I ask you one question? Can
Certainly,
I ask
of course.
The fact that there was no written order prepared on the summary judgment, does that have any impact on the case in your view?
I don't believe so, because the court carried out that order throughout the trial. And I'm sure, and while certainly there were issues being tried, and the issue to be tried as to tower height approval was limited to, did the FAA, because the judge had ruled, his only FAA approval was, did the FAA provide a no-fee did the FAA provide a no-hazard determination? So the idea that there was a full presentation of all the evidence on that, I would just ask the court, look, it's in the record, our proffer of evidence on the issue. There were quite a substantial amount of evidence we would have liked to have admitted.
Evidence in the proffer was not presented, was not admitted during the trial?
We were allowed to submit a written proffer of evidence. The judge never allowed us to go into that. There certainly would have been some, because transmission solution and approved tower height, it was two sides of the same coin, there certainly was some leakage. But trial counsel on my side certainly was trying to honor the judge's instruction and would never have been able to present all of the evidence with the full context and flavor of those two issues. I am certain counsel misspoke when he was talking about what Lincoln County did and didn't do, because certainly the idea that Lincoln County Board of Commissioners somehow gave some approval for anything or tied it to FAA no hazard approval, that is not in the record. What Lincoln County did was certainly there was a resolution that said, we really like this idea. But every piece of evidence I've seen that's in the record as to what Lincoln County, including Mr. Whittemore's testimony and several witnesses from Coyote Springs, said FAA determination wasn't the only step. There were certainly worth things from Lincoln County that had to be done to get approval. Lincoln County was the one who said, you get to put a shovel in the ground and build a tower 1 foot high. We never from Lincoln County got permission to build a tower 1 foot high, much less 650 feet. And Lincoln County was very clear that you have to come to us, go through a development process. In fact, Coyote Springs, and the record will show this, especially on summary judgment and I think in our proffer, that they tried to get that amendment to say, oh, you don't need to do anything else, just build your tower. And Lincoln County wouldn't go there. They said, no, you've got to come back because Lincoln County wanted to have hearings in case some of their citizens objected. They never had those hearings. It just never happened.
Mr. Kennedy, so your colleague over here says that he's cited us numerous authorities that we can consider all of this extrinsic evidence to determine whether the contract is ambiguous. How do you respond to those authorities?
I respond to those authorities with this court's rule that's been in place a long time. You can't manufacture ambiguities by saying, look at all this extrinsic strings of evidence. You have to find the ambiguity within the contract. And I think, Justice Pickering, you pointed out that you have a very general, broad term, structures permitted to be built. I would say that, at a minimum, says you need some kind of legal right to build something for that to be satisfied. When you were talking about legal issues, let's talk about what the FAA determination is. Both the FAA says it itself and case law all says the FAA no hazard determination is permission to build nothing. It is simply, it could be an impediment because the people who actually give you permission to build something, local authorities, perhaps the BLM in this instance, they want to take that into consideration. But it's not permission to do anything. It's those local authorities that had to do it, and everyone understood that, including Mr. Whittemore.
Then why is there a separate definition of building permits?
I think because certainly building permits are important trigger points. I think that when you talk about permitted to be built and building permit, I think that one's a specifically defined term. They didn't define that as a building permit. If they meant building permit, they could have written it.
What about the BLM and the EIS statements that they normally require for permission to do anything of consequence on?
In our proffer, it's very clear, in fact, in summary judgment, it was argued as well that it's not just Lincoln County that has a say in this. It was argued that BLM has to give approvals to be building things and building roads and all the construction to do any of this. And there was at least some belief the military was going to be in all of these forums opposing this.
This is near Nellis,
yes.
On the flight path.
It's on the flight path. Definitely there was a very significant concern that the military was against this and would have opposed it had it ever gotten to the public hearings in Lincoln County about getting permission to build anything.
Did you make a request in your brief that in the event this court were to credit your arguments, that it be reassigned to a different trial judge?
I did not make that request. I tend to feel that that's something that I would leave to this court to determine whether or not the judge has predetermined issues enough that it is necessary. I think that in this instance, the judge certainly had very strong views about what the FAA was and wasn't, and it may be difficult to divorce from those, as well as the judge admitting that at least at some point there was privilege information we never got to see.
That was the point that was of concern to me.
Yeah.
That argument, I'm not sure what you do with it because I don't think, I think it was incumbent on you to go preserve the Whittemore evidence and so on, but I'm concerned about this in-camera inspection issue and how that could be.
I always try and be very reluctant before I argue that judges can't be fair.
Thank you. That's
generally a good strategy.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you very much. This case will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next.